We sang a couple songs this morning, I Need Thee Every Hour, and In the Hour of Trial. And that's very much what the book of Habakkuk is about, the hour of trial, and how much we need God. And just to start out, we all have hard times. That's actually one of the reasons I like the book of Habakkuk so much. Is because we all have hard times. Everybody can relate to Habakkuk. It doesn't matter what age you are, where in your life you are, we've all had hard times and probably will have more hard times ahead. And we all find it difficult to trust God sometimes when we go through those trials, when we go through those hard times. So that's the theme of Habakkuk. That is what he writes about. And that's what we'll look at today. And there's really one key point, key idea that I want to address through this lesson, and it is our perspective on those hard times, how we should see those hard times. Number one, hard times are moments when we face the greatest temptation to turn away from God, and our faith is tested. Hard times are moments when we face the greatest temptation to turn away from God. And number two, hard times invite us to a closer, deeper relationship with God. So it's going to be one or the other. Hard times, we're either going to respond to them by turning away from God, or we're going to respond to them by clinging to Him and drawing near to Him. So let me ask a question. And we should all ask ourselves this question when we think about the hard times we will go through in the future or are going through now. Will we try to do it on our own? Or will we turn to God, live by faith, and trust Him while we endure those hard times? So if you look at Habakkuk chapter 1, we start out with a dilemma. Of course, I said Habakkuk is about hard times, and we're going to very soon see what the hard time Habakkuk is talking about here. But he starts out with this dilemma, this question. He's confused. He doesn't understand why this is happening. Starting in verse 2 of Habakkuk chapter 1, he says, "O Lord, how long shall I cry for help, and you will not hear? Or cry to you violence, and you will not save? Why do you make me see iniquity? And why do you idly look at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise. So the law is paralyzed, and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous. So justice goes forth perverted." So Habakkuk's complaint, he's talking directly to God, and he complains saying, "How long, O Lord?" He's asking, why does God allow wickedness to go unpunished in Judah? And this question, how long, kind of implies that he's been asking this question. How long shall I cry for help and you won't hear me? He's been crying for help. And this idea of hearing, that he's asking God to hear him, it's not just about God listening. He's asking God to act, to do something about this injustice and violence that's going on. He talks about the violence and the iniquity, destruction, strife, contention, the law being paralyzed, and there being a lack of justice. And one other thing to notice from these first few verses and this complaint that Habakkuk has, which he goes to God with, is his candor. It's pretty bold to say to God, "Why do you idly look at wrong?" As if God isn't doing anything about it. But that is the question on Habakkuk's mind and in his heart. And of course, God knows what Habakkuk is thinking. So Habakkuk asks God that very question. And he's honest about what he's struggling with. Well, look at God's response, continuing in verse 5. God says, "Look among the nations and see. Wonder and be astounded, For I am doing a work in your days that you would not believe if told. For behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, who march through the breadth of the earth to seize dwellings not their own. They are dreaded and fearsome. Their justice and dignity go forth from themselves. Their horses are swifter than leopards, more fierce than the evening wolves. Their horsemen press proudly on. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle swift to devour. They all come for violence, all their faces forward. They gather captives like sand. At kings they scoff, and at rulers they laugh. They laugh at every fortress, for they pile up earth and take it. Then they sweep by like the wind and go on, guilty men whose own might is their God. So God responds to Habakkuk, and the first thing that we really see what God is saying is that he is in control. God is in control. In verse 5, he says, "Look, look, Habakkuk, look among the nations and see." See what? What God is doing. This is one of the most practical lessons, I think, from the book of Habakkuk, God's use of the nations. He is telling Habakkuk, "I am in control." And we also, in the second part of verse 5, God tells Habakkuk to wonder and be astounded, "For I am doing a work in your days that you would not believe if told." God's ways are higher than our ways. Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9, his thoughts are higher than our thoughts. Do you ever have a hard time believing that God will do something that he's said he will do? Are there things that God has said that don't make sense to us, that we struggle to understand or comprehend? God says he is working in their days. He is working in Habakkuk's days. But it's difficult. It's difficult for us as men, as humans, to see what God is doing now. It's difficult for us to see that. And we'll come back to that in a little bit. But remember that. It's difficult for us to see what God is doing right now. And then God goes a little bit further than this even. The wonder and be astounded. He says also, "Behold, I'm raising up the Chaldeans," or in other words, the Babylonians. And he calls them a bitter and hasty nation. And then he kind of goes on to describe how vicious and fierce and wicked these people are. And so if we think about this and Habakkuk hearing this from God, as God's people, the Jews or us as Christians, we can see God at work in us, the people who actually love him, who follow him. But to see God working in someone like the Chaldeans, that is very hard to see, to understand, to comprehend. How could God use someone like the Chaldeans? And again, verses 6 through 11 are just a lengthy description of how horrible these people are. But this is God's choice to use the Chaldeans. A good analogy I've heard a preacher down in Florida, Ralph Walker, use. You can substitute any city for, you know, he uses Tampa, but I could say Chicago or Pontiac. But it's analogous, God using the Babylonians here to purge Judah of the wickedness is analogous to God sending hell's angels to clean up whatever city you want to name, Chicago, Pontiac, whatever it might be. They're more wicked, but God's using them to purge the wickedness. So, of course, that's going to leave Habakkuk with more questions. So, continuing in chapter 1 and verse 12, Habakkuk says, "Are you not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One? We shall not die. O Lord, you have ordained them as a judgment, and you, O Rock, have established them for reproof. You who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong, why do you idly look at traitors and remain silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? You make mankind like the fish of the sea, like crawling things that have no ruler. He brings all of them up with a hook. He drags them out with his net. He gathers them in his dragnet, so he rejoices and is glad.
Therefore he sacrifices to his net and makes offerings to his dragnet, for by them he lives in luxury, and his food is rich. Is he then to keep on emptying his net and mercilessly killing nations forever? I will take my stand at my watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what he will say to me and what I will answer concerning my complaint. So we have kind of a second dilemma, a second complaint of Habakkuk in these verses, which is pretty common sense, pretty straightforward. God, how can you use Babylon? How can you use Babylon to answer this problem of the wickedness in Judah? How can you use them? And we see in verse 12 something that understanding the character of God will help us to trust him even when we don't understand. Habakkuk does not understand why God would or could use the Babylonians, the Chaldeans, to purge Judah of their wickedness. So he looks to God's character. He understands that he's from everlasting and he is holy. And because of that, he says, we shall not die. He's got confidence in God, even amongst his doubt. And there's also a realization that he says, you have ordained them as a judgment for reproof. He recognizes, you know what? We have been wicked. We're not righteous. So they are a judgment that you have ordained. But we still might not see how God's character fits with what he is doing here. And you can see this in verse... where is that? Verse 13. We can see how God's... We can see that God's character doesn't fit with what he is doing. As humans, we compare. It's about fairness and who is more or less righteous. Verse 13, you who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong, why do you idly look at traitors and remain silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? We compare. It's not that Israel or Judah is holy or doing what's right. They're not. But they're more righteous. They're better than Babylon. They're better than the Chaldeans. So that's not right, right? For God to use Babylon to judge Judah, that can't be right. We're more righteous than them. And there's kind of one more statement of this question, this complaint in verse 17. Will this go on forever? Will you ever put an end to this? And then there's a good realization in chapter 2, verse 1, that it's time to wait and watch for God. Habakkuk realizes, I've asked my questions, and I don't understand. But now I will wait for God's answer. And so God responds, continuing in chapter 2, verse 2. And the Lord answered me, write the vision, make it plain on tablets, so he may run who reads it. For still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. Behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him, but the righteous shall live by his faith. Moreover, wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. His greed is as wide as Sheol. Like death, he has never enough. He gathers for himself all nations and collects as his own all peoples. So we see a couple things here in God's response, his second response to Habakkuk's second complaint, that God's saying he will judge Babylon as well. You can also see, I stopped in verse 5, but you can also read through the rest of chapter 2 and see God pronouncing this judgment on Babylon, on Chaldea. And we see in verse 2 that God's judgment is certain, and it is coming. In verses 2 and 3, it says at the end of verse 3, if it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. God's judgment will come. It is sure. It is certain. And there's a contrast in verse 4 between Babylon, this idea of their soul being puffed up. We read earlier that their own might is their God. They think so highly of themselves. Versus the righteous. Of course, that should be Judah. And they are supposed to live by their faith. And that is one of the key points in Habakkuk, that the righteous shall live by his faith. Remember that. And there's a call to God's people. This living by faith, the righteous living by faith, is a call both to the collective, to Judah as a people, but also to individuals. It's to us and to all individuals who read this, that as righteous people, we ought to be living by our faith, and the righteous will live by faith. And then the rest of chapter 2, verses 6 through 20, is a song or woes to the Chaldeans that God is basically proclaiming on them why and for what he is judging them. Verses 6 through 8, he tells them that woe to them, the plunderer and the extortioner, because Babylon plundered vanquished nations and forced others to pay tribute to them. Verses 9 through 11, he talks about them building an empire on unjust gain, and woe to them because they built their empire with wealth unjustly taken from other nations. In verses 12 through 14, he talks about woe to those who build a city with bloodshed and injustice. Of course, King Nebuchadnezzar built Babylon with the spoils of unjust wars. And verses 15 through 17, woe to the violent and those who degrade others, which was very common type treatment for the Babylonians and the people that they took captive. They degraded the other nations and treated them violently, and they would reap what they sowed. Verses 18 through 20, woe to those who trust in false gods. Babylon's false gods cannot save them from the judgment of Yahweh, the true and living God. That's the message that God is giving to Babylon and to an answer to Habakkuk here, that God will judge Babylon as well. Well, the last chapter in Habakkuk, chapter 3, is mainly a prayer that Habakkuk gives in response to all of this, that the complaints that he's had and God's responses to him. So look at verse 1, beginning. A prayer of Habakkuk the prophet, according to Shigionoth. O Lord, I have heard the report of you, and your work, O Lord, do I fear. In the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. And we're not going to read all of chapter 3, that we'll just look at some key verses. But do you remember chapter 1 and verse 5, where we talked about that at the beginning, where God said, look among the nations and see, wonder and be astounded, for I am doing a work in your days that you would not believe if told. And we said that it's hard for men to see what God is doing now. It's hard to see what God is doing in the present. And so what do? We look to the past. And that is what Habakkuk does here. I've heard the report of you, and your work do I fear in the midst of the years revived. He goes on to talk about all the things that God has done for them as a people, as a nation. Look at specifically verses 8 and 13. Verse 8, was your wrath against the rivers, O Lord? Was your anger against the rivers, or your indignation against the sea, when you rode on your horses, on your chariot of salvation? Verse 13, you went out for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. You crushed the head of the house of the wicked, laying him bare from thigh to neck. Both of those passages, Habakkuk is saying that God did these things, these judgments, and delivered them to work their salvation. He is remembering what God has done in the past. And that's what we should do when we cannot see what God is doing now or understand what God is doing now. And what Habakkuk is describing here as well in chapter 3 is a theophany, an appearing from God. God is coming down and appearing to him. Habakkuk sees God coming again for the salvation of his people, just as he had in times before. And judgment against the enemies of God always brings salvation to the righteous. So let's bridge the gap a little bit. We see in Habakkuk a proper attitude of humility and rejoicing. Look in chapter 2 and verse 20. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. Also in verse 16 of chapter 3, Habakkuk says, I hear and my body trembles. My lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones. My legs tremble beneath me. Yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon people who invade us. There's a time to ask questions. And there's a time to be silent, especially before God. And he says in chapter 3, verse 16, as we just read, that this day of trouble, this invasion that they can see coming, that Babylon's going to invade them, it's coming. That hasn't changed. But Habakkuk says, I will wait for it quietly. And continuing in the last three verses of Habakkuk, verses 17 through 19, Habakkuk says, though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fall or fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls. Yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God the Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. You realize what Habakkuk is saying here in verse 17? What he's describing? They have no food. This captivity that's going to come upon them, they're going to cut off every source of food to Judah. So Habakkuk is saying, even though I will starve to death, I will rejoice in God. Compare that to Romans chapter 8 and verses 35 through 39. That's a passage that we're pretty familiar with. And it says, who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword? As it is written, for your sake we are being killed all the day long. We are regarded as sheep to be slaughtered. No, in all things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am sure that neither death nor life, nor angels nor rulers, nor things present nor things to come, nor powers, nor height nor depth, nor Chaldeans, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. There's something bigger than the trials, the hard times, the suffering that Habakkuk is going through and that we all go through. And so the main lesson from Habakkuk is the importance and the benefit of having a relationship with God. I just want to look at two other passages and compare them to what we've seen in Habakkuk. A few verses in Matthew chapter 26. Matthew 26, starting in verse 36. Again, that's Matthew 26, starting in verse 36. Then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, sit here while I go over there and pray. And taking with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, my soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me. And going a little farther, he fell on his face and prayed, saying, my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. And he came to the disciples and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, so could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. Again for the second time he went away and prayed, my Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done. And again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. So leaving them again, he went away and prayed for the third time, saying the same words again. Then he came to the disciples and said to them, sleep and take your rest later on, See, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand. So some observations from this. Jesus is very sorrowful and troubled. So much so, in Luke chapter 22 and verse 44, he describes him as sweating blood. That is so, he is so sorrowful and troubled about what he's about to suffer, and that he knows what he's about to suffer. We also see that Jesus pleads with God to let this cup pass. He doesn't want to go through with this, but he also submits himself with the main expression of his prayer being humility, when he says, not my will, but your will be done. And Jesus repeats this prayer three times, the same words. He is persistent in this prayer. He is pouring out his heart to God. And each time he goes to pray, he warns the disciples, saying, watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. And of course, he returns to find them sleeping for sorrow. Notice, Habakkuk does almost all of these things as well. He is troubled. So he pleads with God, but he also humbly submits at the end. He repeats his prayers, his requests, his complaints to God, and he watches. And a lesson for us is that the battle of faith, the battle of trust in these hard times is won on our knees, not literally, not physically, but in prayer. This is how we trust in God. This is how we remain firm in our faith. And this is how we have a relationship with God. One last passage, 1 Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5, starting in verse 6. First Peter 5, we'll read verses 6 through 10. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time he may exalt you, casting all your anxieties on him, because he cares for you. Be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. Resist him, firm in your faith, knowing that the same kinds of suffering are being experienced by your brotherhood throughout the world. And after you have suffered a little while, the God of all grace, who has called you to his eternal glory in Christ, will himself restore, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. So he starts out in verse 6 by saying, humble yourselves. Just as Jesus said, not my will, but your will be done. And Habakkuk said, I will wait quietly. Also notice, at the proper time, he will exalt you. This is also about trusting God's timing and what he is doing in the world. In verse 7, he says to cast your anxieties, your cares, on him, on God, because he cares for you. If Jesus and Habakkuk didn't believe that God existed, that he hears them, and that he cares, there would be no point in crying out to him. I'll say that again. If Jesus and Habakkuk didn't believe that God existed, that he hears, and that he cares, there would be no point in crying out. And yet Jesus did say, let this cup pass from me. And Habakkuk said, how long, O Lord? Ask questions. Lament. Pour out your heart to God. He wants us to stay with him in these hard times. In verse 8, be sober-minded and watchful because Satan is seeking to devour you. Just like Jesus told his disciples, watch and pray. Temptation is the hardest in these hard times. You think Satan is looking for ways
to bring us hard times, because that is when he can snatch us away from God.
And Habakkuk may not have said something, anything like this explicitly, but we can certainly see him doing this very same thing, watching. To share a quote from Nathan Ward's book on prayer, there's a book called Our Eyes Are on You, and it's specifically about this passage in Matthew 26 that we read. He says that Jesus here fights and wins the battle with temptation, and he will go out and succeed when he faces the cross. The disciples, however, fail to pray, and they will fail when the crisis arises. They do not realize just how crucial this moment is, and they allow their heavy eyes and grief to distract them from what is the most important thing they could be doing. And so when they finally rise, they go off in every direction but the one that Jesus leads. I like to think that the only one who prays in the garden is the only one who resisted temptation that night and who went with Jesus, and that was Jesus himself. He is the only one who prayed, and he is the only one who resisted that temptation. But we are to resist the devil, back here in 1 Peter 5, in verse 9. Resist the devil, firm in your faith, knowing that others are suffering as well. And Jesus exemplifies this. The way that we stand firm in our faith is on our knees. It's in prayer. And as God tells Habakkuk, the righteous shall live by their faith, faith in God, going to him. Because suffering is a reality. We have hard times. We already have had hard times in our life, and we'll continue to have hard times in our lives. If nothing else, then that's how Satan tries to get us away from God and has the most opportunity to get us to abandon God and trust in ourselves. So we must rely on God and be firm in our faith by praying to him. And notice in verse 10 that after you have suffered, there's hope. Suffering isn't the end. The hard times aren't the end. There is something that comes after. There's hope. And just right before these verses, in chapter 5, Peter had talked about suffering as a Christian. I just want to read three of those verses, starting in verse 12. 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 12. He says, "Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you, as though something strange were happening to you. But rejoice, insofar as you share Christ's sufferings, that you may also rejoice and be glad when his glory is revealed." And skip down to verse 19. "Therefore, let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing good." We're about to partake of the Lord's Supper. And Jesus' sacrifice on the cross, him giving his body and blood for us, is what makes it possible for us to have this relationship with God, that we can get through those hard times with the hope of Christ's glory and the hope of being restored to him and being with him for eternity. So if there's anything for us to think about during this time, let's think about that.